Today we're at SCI Green, home to Pennsylvania's Death Row. And Pennsylvania's Death Row has been home to one of the world's most recognized political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, for the last 14 years. Mr. Jamal was sentenced to death in 1982 after being convicted in a highly controversial trial of the killing of a Philadelphia police officer. As a former radio journalist and currently as a writer and political commentator, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been called the voice of the voiceless. Last year, while under threat of imminent execution, Mr. Jamal was at the center of another controversial court hearing, and hundreds of thousands of people around the world joined in protest to stop what they believe to be a corrupt system's attempt to once and for all silence the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll talk with Mumia Abu-Jamal about that, MOVE, John Africa, National Public Radio, racism, the death penalty, and what you can do. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and our guest from Death Row is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mr. Jamal, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Last week, a settlement was reached in the 1985 bombing of the MOVE house in Philadelphia. What are your thoughts about the so-called settlement?
Well, my thoughts are somewhat mixed, and I'll tell you why. On the one hand, it was the first time any judicial body in the United States of America condemned the bombing of May 13, 1985. In that respect, it was definitely a step forward. However, upon talking to my sister Pam Africa, I couldn't resist the feeling that people were insulted at the pittance, the amount of money that was rendered by the jury in damages. I understand how she felt, because in America, a capitalist society, things in terms of their value are determined by worth, by money. But Ramona said it best when she said the suit was not filed for money. My sister Ramona Africa said that it was about the principle of standing up to this system for 11 years and getting a declaration against government terrorism and bombing and the dismemberment and murder of 11 people. The real question I think that should arise is, a jury in a United States District Court came back and said, this is unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution, federal law, and state law were violated. The question is, what next? In reality, I think it'll be fair to say nothing next, because even now, politicians in Philadelphia are saying, well, the door is closed. That closed this chapter and MOVE. Well, they didn't open MOVE's door. They cannot close it. People should demand now that criminal prosecutions be opened against officials of the city of Philadelphia for committing premeditated murder 11 years ago. Remember, there is no statute of limitations on murder.
Minister Farrakhan is coming to Philadelphia on the 4th of July to speak at a large rally on your behalf. Do you think that efforts on his part will be able to keep the door open, not only in your case specifically, but the issue of MOVE, and for people who are attempting to struggle against government repression in general?
Well, I would hope so, and I certainly think so. Certainly only time will tell. I think that all people of just fundamental justice and reason and good faith have to feel that this is a door, and again I speak of, you know, my brothers and sisters who were incinerated on May 13, 1985. This is a door that cannot be shut, that cannot be sealed, that cannot be closed. And it really depends on the people, you see. I heard something that distressed me greatly, and that was that during the duration of this civil action in the U.S. District Court, for the most part, the courtrooms were empty. This is a case that is, as a criminal justice professor from Temple said, the police used an unprecedented amount of force. I mean, if you look at American recent history in the last 20 years, the last 30 years, and you talk about the shootouts with the Black Panther Party, you talk about Waco, you talk about Ruby Ridge, you talk about any kind of confrontation between the state and her citizens, quote unquote, you will never find the kind of bullet use, the kind of weaponry, the kind of bombing that you saw in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, on May 13, 1985. It is unprecedented. Well, there's a reason for that. And I think that for people to lay down now, and because a jury came back and said some magic words, what everyone knew, that the city was guilty, well, it's not the end. In truth, it should be the beginning. I mean, this should mobilize people. And never again should Ramona Africa have to walk into a courtroom and find herself alone.
Speaking of being more or less alone in a courtroom, can you talk about your battles with the legal system?
From day one, it has been a battle. From day one, it has been an education, not just for myself, but for myself and for those who view it. Like most people, I mean, I walk into a courtroom with some core beliefs. I mean, and these beliefs were not shattered by my politics or my political history or, you know, what I've read, but what I had been indoctrinated with, you know. It is still unfortunate but real to admit that most people in this country believe in their heart of hearts in the Constitution of the United States. Of course, most people have never had to have direct contact with the state other than a traffic ticket somewhere or, you know, getting a IRS tax bill or an audit or something like that. Their contact with government has been tangential, very, very limited. So when you walk into a courtroom and you've, you know, been through elementary school and so forth, you believe that you have a right under the Constitution to a lawyer of your choice, or you have the right to defend yourself if you so choose, or you have any number of these vast rights that are drilled into our consciousness from the time we're 5 or 6 years old. But when you walk into a courtroom and you try to exercise those rights, you will be educated. I remember standing up in a pretrial hearing and representing myself, as I was told. I'd read that, you know, you could do this, and demanding that the rights under Miranda be applied to me. I mean, demanding. You have a right. A right means something you can demand, correct? When that judge said no, I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather, because I said, oh, boy, he doesn't believe in this Constitution either. And it was an education for me, because I saw that what I had read in law books or what I had read as a child about the Constitution and what I had been taught simply wasn't the truth, that there was another truth when you walk into the courtroom. The late Justice Thurgood Marshall, I think, said it best when he said that reason is not the currency by which the court rules, power is. And he said that, we should remember, after he was no longer a justice. And he said also, I think tellingly, once he was off the bench, the first words he said in his press conference nationally were, "I am still not free." Well, this is a man who was a justice of the highest court in the United States. If he can sit on the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court for almost 30 years and walk off and say, "I am still not free," then what about you? What about me? What about us? And we understand now, thanks to the teachings of John Africa, that freedom ain't in courtrooms. It's in people's hearts, and it's what they fight for. It's what they demand. It's what they live for, and it's what they struggle for. And if necessary, it's what they die for. But it's not something that exists in a courtroom, you know. And it never will be. Courts are not places of freedom. They're places of unfreedom. They're places of restriction. And increasingly, when you read the kind of cases that are coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court and other cases, you find a kind of litany of repression that is unprecedented.
I spoke with Dr. Mutulu Shakur about a year ago. Of course, as you know, he's being held in the federal penitentiary in Florence, Colorado, much under the same circumstances you are. He's not, of course, literally sentenced to death, but his sentence is so long that on some level it almost makes it a moot point. He did say an interesting thing to me, however. He said that black people understood the repressive nature of the system and had understood that for many, many years. He said to me that he felt that white people were going to find out a lot more about that because being white is simply no longer the immunity that it once was. Do you concur with that?
I concur in this respect, that the nature of this society and the nature of repression generally is incestuous. You cannot have the corrupting influence of injustice in one small corner of the system without it polluting and corrupting the entire system. The other side of the coin is that, I mean, let us not assume for the sake of an interview or argument that at the very beginning, the inception of this system, that it was just. I mean, how can we come to that false conclusion? That's a false conclusion. That's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow. In fact, this society was built and constructed on injustice. And as the seed is, how else can the fruit and the tree be? And, you know, this society was born in slavery, in genocide, in mass murder. How could it be, you know, this great society of freedom when it began in the very essence of unfreedom? As regards white Americans, they do have, you know, I think, a rude awakening coming. They have supported a system that has kept quote-unquote niggers in their place for generations, for centuries. What happens is that system, as Lord Acton said, has been corrupted. He says power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. What you have now is a kind of police state where the Supreme Court just said recently they could, you know, stop your car, look in, search it willy-nilly. So, you know, when you get in that little bubble called an automobile or a car and you may have paid, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000 for, well, it's not really your car because you don't have privacy in that car. They can stop it, look through it on a hunch, a guess. So what kind of freedom do you have when you get into a car that you bought, you see? By the same token, the Fourth Amendment, for all intents and purposes, that theoretically protects people against search and seizure, may be thrown out of the door. It may be put in the waste can, flushed down the toilet. Because just like they can go into your car, they can go into your house. A lot of these doors have been opened through the so-called drug war. Well, those doors, once open, will be very difficult to close because judges have given them the sanction, the authority of the state to do whatever they want to do, you know. I mean, when you look at the drug war, I mean, analyze it, okay? What you'll find is that society uses the pretext of drugs to open up the door to repression, to do what they will, to go through people's personal things and effects in the name of protecting people from drugs. And if you look at the population in these prisons, it's 1.6 million people in prisons in America today. Well, perhaps 55, 65, 70% are drug related. That means the vast majority of people in these prisons are here because they were either dealing or using or related to drugs or something like that. When you look at how many people, numerically or percentage-wise, die because of illegal drugs, you come up with this, you know, 6,000 a year. I mean, every person has worth, so I'm not saying the people that suffer are not really suffering and it's not important. But then look at the number of people who die from cigarettes. Look at the number of people who die from alcohol, legal drugs, you know. Corporations who pump billions into politicians' campaigns. And you're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every year, you see. And this is not an academic exercise for me. You know, my mother died of emphysema, you know, lung cancer. She smoked for 30, 35 years, you know, and she loved it. And it killed her, you know. and millions of people in that period of time have bitten the dust because they believe that, you know, Winston takes good or Lucky Strike and, you know, some other nonsense. And they self-administered a poison, a carcinogen, a death bringer in the name of pleasure, in the name of profit, in the name of capital. So, you know, to make a long story short, I believe that what Dr. Mutulu Shakur told you is a truism, because repression cannot be kept in the barrios and in the ghettos. It can't be kept in Harlem, in North Philly. It will spread into Manhattan, you know, and into the other districts. That's the nature of police repression.
We'll be back in just a few moments to continue our conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal from Death Row at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Thank you for tuning in to Faux Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and now we continue our conversation from SCI Green at Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, from Death Row. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. What are the forces that makes Mumia Abu-Jamal not only who, but what he is? I guess what I'm asking is, if someone were to ask you, who is Mumia Abu-Jamal, what would you say to them?
That's a very difficult question, Mike. I would say that I am a man, a revolutionary, a father, a grandfather, a husband, a writer, a thinker, a journalist, an agitator, you know, and maybe not in those order, but then that would probably define me. When you speak of the forces, I am a creation like every other person in this country, a creation of his experiences. I'm a creation of America, of 1960s America, and 1950s America, and 1970s America. In 1980s America. My education was in the streets of America, in the offices and in the organization of the Black Panther Party, as a supporter, reporter of the MOVE organization. All of those things, you know, in some way.
What about your relationship with John Africa and his teachings?
John Africa, a pretty remarkable man in this respect. When I was in the Black Panther Party, and I was very young and very idealistic, I was what one would call a true believer. There were times when I did remark at the distance between leadership and cadre, because I was cadre. I was the guy who was out there on the streets on 3rd Avenue in New York, or on Geary Street in San Francisco, or in Berkeley, selling that Black Panther newspaper you walk by. I was the one selling To Die for the People or Seize the Time. And that was my daily life. That was my daily work. I mean, I wrote and I edited for the paper, but, you know, it was a collective communal activity. It wasn't like that was my job. In the party, we were taught to avoid a kind of sectarian way of thinking, a compartmentalized way of thinking. Thinking from 9 to 5 as a revolutionary was supposed to be an all-day, everyday thing. So, you know, but I cannot ignore that there were distinctions in the party, distinctions according to rank. I mean, you know, there were some people who, you know, wore jewelry and wore very fine clothes and lived in, you know, big houses, and, you know, other people like myself who had the pair of pants they were on and the pair of pants they were washing out for the next day to do the work. I remember thinking about that when I met a man called John Africa, and I sat in a house on Osage Avenue, and my wife and I, and we talked to a man in a sweatshirt, dungarees, and a pair of socks, sitting on the floor, just kicking it, like, just like he was sitting across from you, you know. And what struck me was the kind of equality, the simplicity, and the real open communication. I mean, the questioning. I mean, I remember, unlike a lot of people who may read a quotation of John Africa, I remember him telling me, don't believe a thing I've said, but, you know, listen to it, and if it's true, then deal with it. Question it. I want you to question everything you hear from me. That means something. You know, it's a rare man, a rare leader, a rare teacher who will tell you not to believe a word he says. But this man said this to me. And he said, you know, examine it. You know, question it. And, you know, check it out. But if it's true, deal with it. And that gave his words and his writings a completely different character. And I began to check it out. I began to question it. I mean, and I argued against stuff. And I found that I couldn't argue against the truth. You know, what I found was a ripping away of this system, a fearless shredding of this system from top to bottom. And even today, you know, you can take writings that were done 20, 25 years ago and read them, and they have a freshness because they talk about this reality, how truly corrupt it is. You know, John Africa says, quote unquote, that America is rotten from end to end, unquote, and that the courts are the tools of industrial plague, granting big business privilege to poison our earth, unquote. How true, how fundamental, how it cuts to the heart and the core of what courts are about, what this system is about. And again, to quote John Africa, you know, once you hear the truth, well, the lie doesn't have any room anymore. You know, the power of truth is final. And as a sign of respect to a very wise, God-centered being, man, a manly man who dare to stand up against all of the forces of this system and to fight it with every breath, every iota of his being, I and other MOVE members and supporters say, long live John Africa, as a sign of respect for him.
Is that why John Africa was killed on Osage Avenue?
John Africa was killed on Osage Avenue because the system tried to destroy an idea. If they could have done it without killing him, they would have done that. And it was a continuation, really, of what happened on August 8, 1978. They tried to destroy an idea. And let me illustrate and demonstrate how I can say this. On August 8, 1978, when the city of Philadelphia, hundreds of cops attacked MOVE's home and headquarters in West Philly, a lot of people, or perhaps some of your listeners, may know of the MOVE Nine MOVE brothers and sisters who were innocently held in Pennsylvania prisons doing a sentence of 30 to 100 years, which is what I call a slow death sentence. But they don't know of the other people who were in that house, who were adults, who didn't go to court, didn't go to jail, and went home. 12 people were arrested in that house. Some people, I mean, after seeing this naked terrorism, simply could not handle it. I mean, and I don't begrudge it. I mean, I'm not saying this to, you know, criticize them or slander them or anything. I mean, because it took an incredible amount of courage for these men and women to be MOVE people in Philadelphia at the very beginning. But there were some MOVE people who renounced MOVE, renounced the teachings of John Africa, and they were never tried for murder. They went home. This demonstrates tellingly that the 9 people who remained were convicted not of murder, not of 9 people killing 1 cop who was shot by other cops. They were convicted of being MOVE members, of being committed MOVE members, and of refusing to renounce their belief in the revolutionary teachings of John Africa. That has been repeated time and time and again. We can talk about August of 1978, but when you talk about other Move people who have come up for parole, automatically the system says, well, if you renounce Move and you leave Move, we'll let you out now. Or we won't let you out if you continue to associate with Move. People know that Ramona Africa did 7 long years in a hellhole only because she did not renounce Move. She could have done 14 months, which was the minimum, to a maximum of 7 years. She could have walked out after a year and 2 months if she said, well, that's it. I'm not messing with you Move people no more. She said, you can't tell me not to associate with my family, and you can't tell me what to believe. And I'm going to always be a Move member, long live John Africa. For that, she did 7 years. You know. So don't tell me about the constitutional right of free speech, association, and freedom of religion. It's bullshit. You know, pure, unadulterated bullshit. And that's what John Africa teaches people. And once you see that, well, what you going to do about it? What you going to do about it? Move people are people who have seen that truth and engaged that truth and said, well, this is what we're going to do about it. We're going to unite and we're going to build a revolutionary family, and we're never going to give up.
Certainly, in my reading of Leonard Weinglass's book, Race for Justice, there can very easily be made a case for reasonable doubt. Is the reason that you're still here because you're a living repository of the teachings of John Africa?
Well, I'm fairly certain that, you know, anyone hearing me would say, well, here's a guy that, you know, believes certain things, so he's going to promote his ideas as ideals. Of course I will. I do that unabashedly. I don't apologize for that. However, let us look at what the Commonwealth has said, what the government of Pennsylvania has said. At my trial, they argued that 15 years ago, or thereabouts, he was a Black Panther, and he had been planning to kill cops ever since, and that's why, you know, you should kill this guy. You should give him the death penalty. That was their argument in support of the death penalty. I didn't tell them this argument. I didn't mention the words Black Panther. In fact, I tried to soften the blow, so to speak, by having the full text of an old newspaper article read, which would show some of the party's activities in Philadelphia, which was feeding kids. Which was self-defense against the state, which was the principle that all Black people should be armed in this country. I believe in that completely, you see. But I think what is clear also is that during that time, and what was not disclosed to any member of the defense, is that the state was in possession of FBI files that showed that from the time I was 14 up until, you know, that date, the FBI had been watching me, following me, taping my phone, interfering with my mail, writing letters on my behalf that I had never written. This is what they admit to doing. Trying to frame me for 2 homicides and some robberies. And the only reason I wasn't arrested and locked up when I was 17 was that I was at work when the homicide happened in another country, but they, you know, I was suspect number one. This is in their files. But what it also shows is that for all that time, even though I believe certain beliefs and I worked with certain people and wrote for certain newspapers and, you know, worked as a radical journalist, then I never broke the law. I never broke the law. I committed no crimes. I am not here because of a criminal history, a criminal background, or a crime. I'm here because I have not done what others have done, which is submitted to the state, my body, my soul, my mind, my being. I'm here because I am a revolutionary and continue to be a revolutionary. And what has happened here, since I've gotten here, right here at Greene County, you know, if anything demonstrates that, it is that, you know. The state was forced to admit in a civil trial that they took letters from me to my lawyer, from my lawyer to me, and passed it throughout the government. What is my legal mail doing in the governor's office in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania? They admitted to this. And they say they don't know what happened to it, but you know what happened to it. It's throughout the government. Police department, DA's office, come on. You know, prove me wrong. You see, this is what they admit to doing, even though it violates their own so-called rules. They admit to punishing me for practicing my alleged constitutional right of First Amendment, of free speech, of writing. You see, they convicted me in a hearing in this jail for the offense of being a journalist, for engaging in the business or profession of journalism. You know, they convicted me and sentenced me for practicing my alleged First Amendment rights. John Africa proved and demonstrated and argued years ago, whether you want to believe it or not, that there are no rights in this system. None. None. That if you have to fight and demand for your right, if you have to suffer for a right, then you have no right. Because if I have a right, why should I have to suffer to prove to you that I have it? If I have it, then damn it, give it to me. Where's it been for the last 14 years?
You had an agreement to have your commentaries recorded here at SCI Green, recorded from Death Row, aired on National Public Radio on All Things Considered, which has sometimes been referred to somewhat unlovingly as Some Things Considered. That didn't happen. Why is that?
Well, I think Refuse and Resist put the best hook on this. This, you know, radical group, I think out of Chicago and New York, called it NPR, National Police Radio. What happened, I think, is a confluence of time and power. At the time that I was supposed to air on NPR, budget hearings were taking place in the federal U.S. Congress. And right-wing forces from the Fraternal Order of Police and other related bodies communicated to senators who were looking over the budget of CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, about this great controversy of NPR airing this guy. And NPR, of course, feeling its financial interests being threatened, well, they pulled the plug the day before. You will hear them say today that, oh, well, they have a right to air what they want to air, and, you know, I shouldn't sue them because they didn't air it, something like that. But it's interesting to note that they didn't make that argument when the FOP told them not to air my commentaries. They asked for those commentaries. They shaped those commentaries. They edited those commentaries. And we worked together to do those commentaries. They told me, we're excellent. Oh, great work. Oh, loved it. You know, and it wasn't until the day before that they choked. I'm not surprised, you know. I mean, in America, everything must bow to capitalism. Everything. This is a capitalist society, and that means it interpenetrates everything within the society. One would think that, well, you know, public radio, that's not really, but it's really integrated as well. I mean, because were it not for Congress, who organized the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, they would not be. Public radio would not exist. So they had to make a choice about, you know, their integrity as journalists or their financial bottom line, and they made a bottom line decision.
And we'll be back in a few moments continuing our conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal.